So, welcome. I'd like to begin tonight with a little bit of contemplative practice. Very simple, very short, but just to get our body, speech, and mind settled. Let's first of all settle the body in its natural state by bringing the awareness into the field of tactile sensations throughout the body. Be mindfully present of the sensations arising within this field, and setting the body at ease in relaxation and comfort. Resting it in stillness and in a posture of vigilance with the spine straight, the sternum slightly raised so that you can breathe effortlessly down into the belly. And you may take three slow deep breaths, breathing down into the lower abdomen, then expanding the diaphragm and finally breathing into the chest. Breathing in and then effortlessly releasing the breath, breathing in and out through the nostrils three times. Then settle the breathing in its natural rhythm, breathing as effortlessly as possible, as if you were deep asleep. Then settle your mind in a state of ease, of comfort, relaxation. With each out-breath, release any involuntary thoughts, images, memories that may have arisen. Release your awareness into the present moment. In stillness, in clarity. And let's bring this initial session to a close. Lasso. So much of the lecturing and writing I've done over the years is basically a continuation of questions that I was struggling with as a youth growing up in Southern California through my teens. Two large ones that have really captured my attention ever since. On the one hand, the interface between science and religion or science and spirituality. Each religion, like Christianity, presenting quite a comprehensive and overarching view of reality as a whole. But science, too, now, is seeking to explain the whole of reality, not just carving out a particular niche and saying, well, we'll just cover the physical, but we'll leave the spirit or God or consciousness to, let's say, theologians. That day is finished. And so this whole interface trying to see, to seek out coherence, where to a large extent what at least presents itself to us initially is decoherence, disintegration, rivalry, people looking for a, what's it called, a zero net game, something like that. That is, somebody loses, somebody wins, right? So the fundamentalists on the one side saying, we've got to win, and then we have fundamentalists on the scientific side seeking, you know, a total win. And to my mind, they both lose in that endeavor. It's a no-win possibility. So there's one whole area, and I've written and spoken extensively about that. But the other one, the other large issue that I've been concerned with, attending to for a very long time, is also the interface between the great religions or spiritual traditions of the world. And once again, we find fairly frequently assertions that we Christians, we Jews, Buddhists, Hindus, Muslims, and so forth, we have the only way. We got God's ear, or we discovered enlightenment, we have what's really going on. And insofar as your views differ from ours, well, you're just flat out wrong. And if you think you can find any salvation except for by way of our path, well, you're wrong again. And so I was certainly exposed to that type of exclusivism as I was growing up. And it frankly never made any sense to me at all. It made even less sense that I would adopt a religion as being the only way based upon the accident of where I was born and the family in which I was born. You know, so I happened to be born in California in a Christian family. Therefore, because of that circumstance, then I should believe that Christianity is the only faith. That seemed about as sensible as being born in a Brahmin family in Bombay and believing Hinduism was the only way, or a Buddhist family in Hazza, Buddhism the only way, and so forth and so on. That just made no sense to me at all. But it's also quite obvious that these great religions or spiritual traditions of the world do say different things. And so what gives? I mean, I really struggled with this in my late teens. I struggle a lot less now. But what gives? I mean, they do really seem to be saying very different things about reality. So one easy answer would be, well, they're just all wrong. They're just conjuring up one superstition after another, and they're all just as wrong can be, and so they all have that in common. They are all incorrect. And therefore, by default, did anybody get the correct take on what's taking place in reality? Well, science would certainly rise up as a big option. But I wasn't really content with that. It struck me that there were too many truths in Christianity, the faith in which I was raised, to throw it out lock, stock, and barrel. And yet there it was. And the spiritual tradition in which I then immersed myself at the age of 20 was Buddhism. But immediately there are a lot of very, very clear differences between these two. So are they just saying radically different things about reality? Is Buddhism fundamentally really correct and Christianity just got it all wrong, and Judaism, its Judaic roots, are simply wrong? How can we understand these, especially in the light of the fact that there clearly are a lot of doctrinal differences between the two? And so I've been looking into this area, just finished another book that will come out probably later this year from Columbia University Press that addresses this topic. Again, in interface with science, but a lot of interface between these two traditions, and seeking out common ground that is not trivial and that is not heretical. That is, we can find heretical Christians that are, you know, rejected by their own churches, that they may come up with statements that the Buddhists would embrace and say, oh, that a boy, you left your own tradition, you more came to our side. You can find people like that, and I'm sure you can find, oh, there are Jubus, and I heard recently there are Kabus. The Jubus we know, I mean, these are Jewish. I mean, a large percentage of Buddhists in the West come from a Jewish background, and we know they're called Jubus. Just a couple of days ago, I learned about Kabus. Kabus are people with a Roman Catholic background. Catholic Bus. And that makes me a Babu, because I was raised in a Baptist background. And so loose Bu and so forth and so on. But we have a lot of these. But can we find, it would be quite remarkable if, given the radically different beginnings of, let's say, Christianity, of course having its tracing back to Judaism, the book of Genesis, with these remarkably different ways of launching into a presentation of reality, in the beginning God created. And then we go to Buddhism, there was no beginning and God didn't create anything. Okay? Completely diametrically opposed. And there are many, many other differences as well. And the whole notion of divine retribution, divine reward, nowhere to be found in Buddhism. Reincarnation, very prevalent in Buddhism, very marginal in Christianity, even though about 25% of Christians nowadays do believe in reincarnation, but not with a whole lot of authorization from their church. They do it on the sly. And so, but you know, given the very great differences in the doctrine, can there be, despite those very real differences, any deep underlying ground? And especially when we look at Christianity and Buddhism, not simply as here's a worldview, live in accordance with it, which is often how religion is presented. Here's the truth, here's God's commandments, obey and you'll get a good reward. Don't obey, well, you'll be sorry. Okay, that's one way of looking at any religion. You know, just obey, embrace the faith, you know, be good, conform, and all will be well, as opposed to the notion of Christianity, Buddhism, and of course other traditions as being actual paths to spiritual maturation, to awakening, to enlightenment, but a real radical transformation of the individual. And that, of course, is the emphasis I'll be placing tonight in this paths to perfection. Now, we'll go to the framework of Buddhism, but I'm going to be looking at points of interface with Christianity. But the first noble truth in Buddhism, of course, is the reality of suffering. But let's go immediately to St. Augustine, widely regarded as the greatest theologian in the Christian tradition after St. Paul, accepted as a great authority by Protestants and Roman Catholics alike, so a major heavy hitter in this tradition. And he makes a statement from the early 5th century in terms of his diagnosis as a brilliant philosopher of the real causes of the miseries of life. He says these are two, the profundity of ignorance and then the love of things vain and noxious. He says there's the reality of the source of suffering. Vain and noxious, I like his, it's got a kind of catchy phrase. There you go, getting vain and noxious again, you know. But I think we can relate to that. Love of things vain and noxious, that is an addiction, a fixation, a craving for things that have no chance of leading us to any kind of sense of fulfillment, of satisfaction or meaning, basically just killing time. And then the profundity of ignorance, well, there we go. Now, classic Buddhism, that is stemming right to the teachings of the Buddha himself 2,500 years ago, and this in the terms of identifying the second noble truth, and that is the source or the origin of suffering, he said, it's ignorance and craving. Ignorance is the bottom line. Ignorance and manifest in craving, where we deludedly pursue things as actual sources of happiness, which are not, and we misapprehend the actual causes of suffering. So, just for starters, there seems to be some parallel there, and by people who are utterly representative of their traditions. But let's proceed, see where it goes from here. Let's go right now to the third noble truth. The third noble truth is the reality of liberation, the possibility of freedom. And here's one of my favorite brilliant minds or characters, individuals from the Christian tradition. He was a cardinal in the Roman Catholic Church, a true Renaissance man in the mid-15th century, brilliant man, a jurist, a statesman, a theologian, an astronomer, a mathematician, and a contemplative. And he dealt in all of these areas with extraordinary insight and erudition. And he was, by the way, never condemned by his church, which is kind of a cool thing, too. And so he described liberation as follows, and I will read it. Finally, and so he lays out different ways of seeking God, including seeking outwards, seeking to understand the mind of the Creator by way of understanding the creation. And so he actually lays a template for science as a spiritual quest for understanding reality as a means to knowing the mind of God. But then he said, finally, there is still the path of seeking God within yourself, the path of the removal of limits. When you conceive that God is better than can be conceived, in other words, transcends all conceptual frameworks, you reject everything that is limited and contracted. If you seek further, you'll find nothing in yourself like God. That is, within this kind of individuated ego, this little self here encapsulated in space and time, you'll find nothing in yourself like God, but rather you affirm that God is above all these as the cause, beginning, and the light of life of your intellective soul. In other words, the very luminosity of your own awareness is none other than God. You'll rejoice to have found God beyond all your interiority. So it's an interesting point here. As a path of contemplative inquiry, he's saying direct your awareness inwards and then go so penetrate so deeply inwards you go beyond the inner, where the very notion of inner versus outer makes no longer any sense. Beyond all your interiority, you will rejoice to have found God beyond all your interiority as the source of the good from which everything that you have flows out to you. So somehow have an inner sanctum beyond the very division of inner and outer, a source of all good that is none other than God, and who can be known. So this is clearly a pursuit of knowledge, not simply an affirmation of faith or an adoption of a certain creed or belief system. So I think very eloquent, and clearly this man is a consummate theologian of his own tradition. He didn't get to be cardinal and actually a confidant of the Pope of his time. He was sent by the Pope as an emissary, as a peacemaker all around the Mediterranean basin, especially in engaging with the Muslim world on the eastern shores of the Mediterranean, Turkey, in Constantinople in particular. But now we go to the Buddhist view.